Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare to order. It is Thursday, February 11th at 8 a.m. here in beautiful Oregon. We want to start out the day with an informational hearing. We passed a wonderful bill last time, last session in 2009, House Bill 2009, and under that was where we implemented the physician's orders for life-sustaining treatment paradigm, and we would like to have Dr. Toll, Susan Toll from Oregon Health Sciences University, and evidently Dr. Ritu Sawhney is in traffic somewhere, and then Bob Shook can come up if he would like also, and Bob Shook was, please come forward. And we will, Bob Shook was my administrator last session, and he's now working with the ethics division, I don't know the proper name, at Oregon Health and Sciences University. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I am Dr. Susan Toll, and I direct the Center for Ethics in Healthcare. I'm also a founding member of the Oregon Pulse Task Force. That task force came into existence in 1990. And I'm a member of the new Pulse Registry Advisory Committee for the state. And what we would like to share is a packet of materials, and we'll walk you through the packet, that talk about what has been accomplished. So there is a two-page narrative, a cover letter, and the narrative links step-by-step each of these packets.
I think we need to get the packet.
Yes, you do.
Got the packet, yeah, that's it.
Is it up here?
For some reason...
Oh, here it is.
Should everybody over 65 on the panel fill one out?
No, sir.
We don't hear what they say. They have to fill it out.
No, sir.
Okay, we have them.
All right. And so what I'd like to begin with is looking at a flow sheet that illustrates our public-private partnership, that the Center for Ethics and Healthcare began the Pulse program in 1990, and is a national innovator with Pulse. Over 30 states have Pulse-like programs now. This timeline is the innovation of our newest innovation, the Electronic Pulse Registry. And as you can see, as you look across the pink portion, which is the portion funded by the Center for Ethics and Healthcare, that we began with some initial grant funding from the Greenwald Foundation in New York, and began building the registry in 2008, did lots of work to assure that this would be error-free, launched in Clackamas County, and then with this committee and the support of the legislature passing statewide implementation, we began statewide education, all with private philanthropy. If Ritu is able to arrive in time, he will talk about the legal side of this and the implementation. If he doesn't, I will pick that up at the end. The second handout with this packet is a map by county with numbers in it that indicate that we have been educating leading healthcare professionals in every county in Oregon. We've developed a video, information packets, PowerPoint slides, and it's a train the trainer. We have taught leaders in every hospice program, every nursing home, every hospital, and anyone who is really a leader in end-of-life or palliative care, however they're affiliated. So the Oregon Pulse Task Force has educated over 4,000 healthcare professionals in Oregon to be able to then teach within their facilities how to implement the Pulse program even more effectively and the Pulse Registry. We took the opportunity to better educate about Pulse at the same time. And as you can see, there's not a single county we have not reached with our intensive educational programs. The next thing is a new Pulse form. We retooled the bright pink existing Pulse form following your legislation here last session. to be more compatible with the registry, more demographics up in the box because we have to be able to better identify the person. But on the back of the form, some things are very important and relate specifically to the legislation. For example, there's an opt-out box. The statute specifically allows people to opt out of the registry. And one of the most important things about this program is it is entirely voluntary. You do not have to have a pulsed form. You can fill it out any way that suits who you are and what you want. You can change your mind and have another one. And you can opt out of the registry. If you opt in and decide you would like to be in the registry, and most people want to and want their wishes to be found, then the statutes you all created mandate that the healthcare professional who signs the form must submit. So that offers protections under the HIPAA privacy rules so that forms can be submitted without extra authorizations and greatly increases the success of the registry. The next item in your packet is a flow sheet that shows how pulsed forms come into the registry. We've talked thus far about the side that I'm the most involved in, which is helping primary care professionals complete pulsed forms, fill them out. And when they are readily available, everything works well. But sometimes they can't be found. And the result is the registry and forms coming in across the fax machine to the registry. When they come in either from hospitals, from clinics, from long-term care facilities, hospice programs. A small number are coming directly from patients and families. That is not the majority. The majority are coming from the healthcare system. They come into the registry office.
Let me ask Dr. Sawney to come forward.
Oh, please join me.
Okay.
We understand. We went around
it.
Madam Chair, yes. I was told there was a large, something of an accident on I-5 this morning.
There was.
At the interchange at 205, headed south.
Okay. Yeah, so a lot of people, yeah. I got a call from Representative Kotek, a couple others on other issues. They couldn't get here for a while.
It wasn't my fault.
No. Not this time.
Right. It takes me
35
minutes to get here, and it took me 95.
Yeah.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
So where we are, for those who have joined us, is in this overview packet, we outline, and you'll be able to catch up with us, what we have done in statewide education, how we have implemented the program, and we are to what I think is the most exciting part, which is how is it working. So you haven't missed a thing.
You mean it doesn't work?
No, it works amazingly well.
I just wanted to be sure.
That's the exciting part. That's why we're here. So we have forms come in. They are reviewed carefully, and if they have all the required elements, they are entered within 48 hours. We do have crews working on Saturdays, so we're loading 6 days a week. If there are problems with the forms, and we'll come back to that, then we need to get full and completed forms before they can be entered into the registry. This is the page you were all waiting for. This is the cumulative volume of forms submitted. This is how far we have been able to come in this period of time. Official launch statewide was December 3rd. We have received just over 10,000 forms submitted to the registry when you count duplicates. And that's pretty fast out of the blocks for a new program, and obviously means we're loading over 100 forms a day, 6 days a week, and we are able to keep up with the volume. We've had one time where we didn't meet 48 hours. Our contract is 10 days. So we have a very hard-working crew loading very rapidly and getting these forms activated into the registry. So it's an exciting time for us to have crossed that mark in such a short period of time.
Just a question on that. Is there checks and balances to make sure that the data is entered in appropriately?
Absolutely. Every single form is entered by one research assistant. and checked by a second person, so that we have an absolutely zero error rate. We absolutely cannot make a mistake with this. And there are double checks. There are actually several others that got put in by rule, and Ritu will talk about those, including our check, do they have a current license in the state of Oregon? We have found some who didn't. So we'll come to that.
Really? Who signed the polls?
Yes, they do not have a current license in the state of Oregon, and we can review who all of those are if you have interest in what we're finding in that vein. But it does mean we have more people who can't be entered up front than we would have guessed in the first place.
Okay.
Now, one thing I want to emphasize is the demand our educational programs have put on the Center for Ethics and Healthcare. We normally distribute 7,000 forms a month, blank forms, to nursing homes and other programs per month. In the last 3 months, November, December, and January, with our intensive educational programs and Go Live, we have distributed 45,000 POLST forms out of the Ethics Center, remembering that most major health systems are printing their own. So that's not even the total. So we're going to see a lot more forms coming in because those are all the blank ones going out. So we can see that that will happen pretty quickly. The next graph.
You're going to the map now.
I'm going to the map now.
Okay, because I got questions about the map.
So. There you go.
Okay.
This map illustrates the first and most important message of this map is this is the zip code of the person who submitted or who has a POLST form in the registry. So we have people in every single county who have POLST forms in the registry. This is already a statewide registry, even in 2 months of operation, which we think is very exciting and wonderful and means that our educational outreach is reaching the whole state. It is not evenly distributed who is in the POLST registry. We pilot tested in Clackamas County. That gave them a real jump start. When you look at the percentage here, we wanted to make big and small counties equal by because this is a ratio. So it's as a percentage of the number of people who are 65 years of age or older in that county. So we can compare big and small counties, and the percentages are the percent of those over age 65. We do not think the number should ever be 100%. We believe that most people over age 65 are too healthy to have a POLST form. We think the number should probably be in the neighborhood of 10%. And so at this moment, we think we have about 10% of existing POLST forms in the state of Oregon in the registry 2 months into operation. We are using this map in part to target areas that need more educational intervention, where we need to actually take teams like Deschutes County and help with education to get the percentage up higher. But the biggest message from this is it's working everywhere. People do know how to submit, and we will continue to help each organization, health system, practice, better understand how the registry can serve their communities. The next thing I have is not in your packet, so we're going to take just a moment and hear.
My map questions.
My map questions. Yes. I love map questions.
I'm assuming it's Grant County that's 4.68%. Why? I mean,
we had a team go over there and do hands-on education in Grant County, and 36 people came to that presentation.
Okay, so that was an enhanced effort.
It was an enhanced effort, and what happens is when you send a team and you end up with a person who wants to take charge and maybe get their hospital all on board, and you link with an activist in that region, you get a real spark plug and a region takes off.
Okay.
And that's what happened in Grant County. We found just the right person that said, I want to be a champion for this. This is really important. They can be EMS. They can be a palliative care person. They can be a hospice leader. They vary by county. And obviously, really big counties need more than one spark plug to make the whole region go.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I looked at Clackamas and Grant, and they stand out far above the rest, although Malheur is way above the rest of Eastern Oregon, which is also interesting.
We did send a team there.
Okay.
And you have fewer populations, it's easy to maybe get all those 65 and over.
You can get all of the healthcare professionals into the same room sometimes.
Yeah. Right.
For big meetings where it's been much harder to herd them, for example, in Portland.
Yeah, you get into Malheur County, your next door neighbor's 10 miles away. But
yeah.
I would guess what happened was you probably went to a couple of nursing homes there, a couple of foster homes, and signed up the hospital, and within a couple of weeks you would have a huge population in comparison to the total population.
That's exactly what happens.
Is that what happens?
That's what happens. And in the future we will report to you new forms only going forward, so that if a large retirement community submits several hundred, as happened, for example, at Mary's Woods, you don't tip the balance of what's really happening at the ground with all of the healthcare professionals. And we will be providing you that data at our next presentation for the next session.
Excellent. Senator Morsette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You answered part of the question. You do work through the nursing homes and so on and so forth. But my question is about Lane County. Do you know anything about the... There is a group in Lane County which I belong to on their board. It's Senior Connections, and it's through the Council of Governments, and they have an outreach program to all seniors, but I'm interested in that.
Yes, we have a number of different connections in your region. We work with every hospice program, every long-term care facility, and every hospital. And so we have people that we have sent educational packets to, but we haven't personally gone down
and
made that presentation.
Too good yet. I mean, it's...
There's further work to be done.
Okay. I'll talk with you about that, and I'd like to help with that.
Excellent. Yeah. We welcome that. We welcome all of the educational outreach, because that's where we are now, is targeting the holes, like the Swiss cheese, of who's not yet involved and not submitting. Now, we have pushed much harder to get forms in. It makes little sense to have emergency medical personnel call a registry if there are almost no forms in it. They're going to get no answers. They're going to get discouraged. They won't keep calling. So in the first 2 months, the big push has been, send us your forms. And very little push, unless we have a county with about 4%, call from EMS. So the intensive education about EMS has not been statewide, because we don't want to discourage them for a couple more months till we get a higher volume of post forms into the registry. So when you hear these call numbers, know it's without the intensive push that we have done to get the forms in. In 2 months that the registry has been active, since December 3rd statewide, we have had 57 calls from EMS to the Emergency Communication Center. What it first shows is that the center is working perfectly. Those calls, on average, are responded to completely with searches from the data of somebody found down and matching in less than 2 minutes, and that 7 of them have been a match. Now, I've told you I thought we had about 10% of the state's post forms, so every month as we get a higher percentage, the percent matches is going to go up. 3 of those were from EMTs in the field. 4 of those were from emergency rooms calling. 1 person was terminally ill. 3 were in respiratory arrest. So the system works. We don't have most of what they need, so most of the time we're still telling the EMTs, I'm sorry, we don't have it. And some of them are very sad stories, and we're very eager to further populate the registry. Then I'd like to turn last to this.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morris, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Thank you. 2 questions, if I may, Madam Chair. I'm a little concerned in Lynn County, that's the county that I represent, only 11 for healthcare professionals have been involved. And I'm wondering if we have a train the trainer within Samaritan Health, or are we actually deficient?
You have 2 things, and it's very good. You have Dr. Taki May, who is totally awesome spark plug that is making a lot of things happen in the Albany area. You also, when I gave you these numbers, this means that we knew what county they're from. If you add up all these numbers, you realize we only knew the county for about half of these people. And another half came, but they went to some sort of statewide meeting where they weren't in their county at the time we did the training. They might have been in Portland, for example. And so lots more people than 11 have been trained by us in your county and in all the other counties. But they were trained in, for example, at the statewide palliative care conference when 500 people came. They were trained at a statewide rural health conference. And when we recorded, we knew how many and what discipline they were, but we didn't record their counties. So it actually is a lot more than 11. And we have been to each of the Samaritan hospitals but one. We have held trainings in Lebanon, in Corvallis, at Albany, and in Newport, but we have not yet been to Lincoln City. We'll be there this summer. Mm-hmm. So we've actually done extremely well with the Samaritan system, with much more hands-on education than anywhere else. But several of them were a little later in fully implementing parts of the PULSE program, so getting it fully integrated and submitted, they're a little bit behind, but for a different reason. Okay. But they have had the education.
Good. Thank you. A follow-up question?
Yes.
As I look at the form, I have a sense that this is really dedicated at the advanced geriatric skilled nursing home setting, as opposed to, I mean, I'm now a senior citizen, as most of us are in this building, many of us are, but it doesn't seem to address the circumstances by which I would fill this out.
That is correct. I don't know you well, but you look too healthy.
Okay. Thank you. I am healthy as far as I know, but it's important to me, and I do have an advanced directive that I have
exactly
prepared.
Yeah.
But who in the world has that?
And the pathway
for someone like me or us.
Yes.
Is there a form that would be available that has a little more? How would I say it, Doctor?
Depth to it,
yes.
Perhaps horsepower. For persons who are healthier, an advanced directive is the right thing to do. And when you appoint someone, should you, for example, have been the unfortunate person on I-5 this morning and have been permanently brain injured and have an advanced directive, and a month from now still not be waking up and wish it to go into effect, then the person you have appointed on your advance directive can meet with the physician and a PULSE form can be completed for you and turned into action at a time of need. This is much more action-oriented. It's not a future document. It's not a document like an advance directive that says, if these things happen to me, then I would want. It is here and now tonight, if I'm found down, do this and do not do that. All of us are healthy enough that we're wanting everything done and then figure it out and then talk to my surrogate if I am not recovering. And here's the things I want and don't want. So it's a two-step process for the healthy. It is not just for seniors, though. I want to correct that. It's for anyone with advanced chronic illness. You can be very sick and be 20. You can be one of the patients seen in Dornbecker and fourth-round chemotherapy and decide to go home to Roseburg and be with your family at the end, and while you're traveling down the highway, this would be with you in the car should you not survive the trip. So it is primarily, however, for people over 65, because three-quarters of people who die in this state are over age 65. So the majority of people who have PULSE forms are older. Many are quite frail in senior living situations. But it's a combination, and it's designed for anyone with advanced illness or frailty.
I'm not sure if I may continue the
yes
discussion. When we were originally looking at this issue and implementing it, I had the impression that we would afford people in our health and age group the opportunity to get that advanced directive in a registry. So if I'm in Burns, Oregon, and I have the unfortunate accident, that they would know immediately, they could access that registry and know what my wishes are with respect to, you know, emergency treatment.
An advance directive is not part of this registry. It is only post forms. And that is because that is what emergency personnel need. They must have medical orders. An advance directive is a statement of values and requires decoding. So it cannot be applied in the field. It is useful once you're already at the hospital, for example, in a family meeting in the intensive care unit. So your response time for an advance directive can be substantially longer because it's not when you're found down. They cannot apply it. They don't know if you meant today. They don't know if you meant in this setting. It's signed by you. It's not signed by a healthcare professional. EMS follow protocols signed by healthcare professionals. So we knew that the registry, we wanted to make it as lean and efficient as possible for emergency response. It would have been far, far more expensive had we also been uploading advanced directives. It would have slowed the speed in the communication center if we had more Harriet Jones, who also had advanced directives. So for speed of response, we needed this to be medical orders only.
More Morissette and then Senator Bates.
Okay, well, very quickly, I also have constituents in Linn County. I shared that county with Senator Morrison. I've been working with Scott Bond, who is the Western Cog Council, and you should be working through the Western Cog Councils as well. I don't know if you are working with councils.
What we are working with as best we can is the strength in any community. And we are hoping that our community leaders, the strength in the Samaritan system, the strength in the Peace Health system, the strength at McKenzie-Willamette, the networks that they have for nursing homes or hospice programs, should be working with your leaders. But we have a lot of people to reach, so we're trying to do more of a train-the-trainer model of strengthening communities and giving them resources. If the communities don't have strength, then we'll go out with a team to somewhere like Harney County. Okay.
One more.
Okay. And Senator Morse.
Bates.
Or Bates.
I just want to clarify something here. I want to make sure we're all clear on what the pulse form is. Sometimes we are so deeply into pulse and advanced directives, we spend our whole lives with it, we have a hard time getting back to the public a little more information that makes a little more sense to them, because we're just like into it. So I'm going to try to do that, and I'm hoping I'm going to be successful, Frank, if I'm not, correct me. And Dr. Toll, correct me too. The pulse form can be used by anyone who is an adult and of sound mind, basically, of any age. And it tells us at the moment when somebody is not breathing, doesn't have a heartbeat, and can't talk to us, what that person wants done at that moment. Because we have to make a decision within a few minutes, otherwise they'll die. An advanced directive is a little different situation. It is obviously usually an 8 to 10 page form. It has a whole bunch of stuff in it, which includes giving other people power over you when you can't speak for yourself, but you're still breathing, you're still functioning, but unable on a cognitive basis to deal with this. So we try to direct this forum primarily to people who would have the greatest value for. Not excluding anybody, but who has the greatest value for. Generally speaking, and there's no absolute perfect situation, generally speaking, it's people like you and I over 65 who have a higher risk of a sudden event occurring, whether it be a stroke or a heart attack or a pulmonary embolus, things that might suddenly happen to us that would render us a situation where we'd have brain damage and would have a questionable chance for survival. It allows us to put that together. So if you're out in Eastern Oregon fly fishing and you have a sudden event of a terrible stroke or a heart attack or whatever, although you don't look like you're going to have one, okay, and I hope you never do, if an EMT arrives there, they can answer this and say, what did Frank want done? And this goes to pop up, okay? The other issue is the one Dr. Toll spoke to is there are people who are pretty high risk at different ages, not, you know, because of other medical conditions, and we would ask them to let us know when that's what they want done too. Not that they wouldn't want anything done, it just says, what do you want done? Mm-hmm. And they want everything done or not, and mm-hmm. it's amazing the variation when you talk to patients. I've had terminal patients who want everything done.
Absolutely.
Terminal patients who don't want anything done. Yeah. Patients who I've actually talked out of basically, wanting nothing done, and say, and have to say, well, look, you're healthy. You're, there's no reason to do that. Think about this a little bit. You know, maybe you would recover. You know, you have those long discussions with patients.
Right.
Your entry into the system could be in many ways. One, you might be admitted to the hospital for a simple procedure, and you'd be offered this form to fill out if you wanted to. Your primary care or specialist should have this in his office. We keep this in all our rooms, sitting out where patients, when they're waiting in the room, have nothing better to read. They look at this, okay? Because all our magazines are 5 years old, as you know. Doctor's office, okay? National Geographic's from 1972. But they look at this there. So there's those areas, nursing homes. So we're trying to distribute this in a way that people can see it, understand it, and make a choice if they want to. Right? Is that...
That is absolutely fair, and what we're really saying is that people with advanced frailty in long-term care facilities often mark this form, I don't want to go to the ICU. So they mark limited interventions. They say 60 easy things, and it has changed the course of care. Because we're nearing the end of the time, I'll move on to the next and last piece of information. This graph is the big picture of where things are with the registry and what challenges and successes we face. In this graph, you will notice that there are forms that are archived. This is a very fluid process. Some patients have a second pulse form. We archive the first one. Some patients are deceased in hospice, and we archive the pulse forms, wanting to keep what's in the registry searchable fast. Mm-hmm. The green box is our challenge. It is what you will be hearing from us about in the next legislative session when we talk about the post registry in 2011. When we had gone in, we had estimated that the number of forms we could not enter because there was something often incomplete. And the biggest incomplete is no date signed. It's not a valid order. I don't know if this is the most recent. We cannot enter them without a date signed. And so we call them non-registry ready. Some of them are completely illegible, and we can't read them. We get back to the healthcare providers. It's very labor-intensive for us. We had estimated this would be 5%. This is 12%. It is costing us a great deal of staff time. We're doing educational interventions and other things. We hope that number will go down some over time. But the manpower to go back and get these corrected so that they can be loaded. Patients and families, of course, think it's been submitted, I'm in, everything's fine. It, of course, is distressing if they learn they are not valid forms. So that's one of the challenges.
12%.
The overall, though, the message is this program is fully operational. It's being embraced by primary care providers at a remarkable rate. I don't think anyone thought we would hit 10,000 in the first 2 months of full statewide operation. That's embracing something new fast. And the slope, as you can see, is very steep, and it looks like February will be a higher rate of submission than January was as new programs come on board. That we are loading faster than we're required to by contract. We're double-checking. We've had no errors. And that we are able to respond to the calls out of the emergency communication system and search these databases as fast as we had hoped we would and get information where it's needed. The biggest shortcoming is we only have 10% of forms right now, and so there are a lot of phone calls that don't match, and that our labor costs are greater because in large part of these non-registry-ready forms. I personally would like to express my gratitude to every member of this committee. We are doing something that is leading the country in a new innovation with the POST program. It works, and it's going to work far better to better serve our citizens in the coming months as we populate this registry. A lot of the success is because of some very specific things that you wrote in the legislation that I would invite Ritu to share. Dr. Sani.
Good morning. Again, I apologize for running late. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Ritu Sani. I am the medical director of the state EMS and trauma program, which is in the public health division of the Oregon Health Authority. In addition to that, I am also a practicing emergency physician, and as such, find the pulse form to be pretty invaluable to my practice as an emergency medicine doctor. I also am a medical director of an EMS agency, and my paramedics and EMTs also find these forms invaluable. And when we talk about those cases where there's a known pulse, but we can't find it, this particular service in general is kind of a no-brainer and very beneficial for EMS and emergency care providers. I had some prepared remarks. We're over our time. I think the few things that I had wanted to point out, I will still point out very briefly. This is a great example of what happens when you have public-private partnership. Government sometimes is not known for moving at light speed, but when you really look at the timeline on how we got this done, it's really quite impressive. From the time the legislation was signed to the time that we were operational in the Pulse Registry was less than 6 months, which is, I think, a testament, actually, to the commitment that we had with the relationship with the OHSU Center for Ethics and the Pulse Registry Pulse Registry group on our end. A couple of things about the legislation that I think that are important are, number one, the Pulse Registry legislation is very specific in that it only creates the registry. So the Pulse program itself and the forms and the education still are maintained within the Center for Ethics at OHSU, and that our focus at the state office is the functionality of the registry. So our rules and our contract with OHSU are focused on making sure the registry meets goals. The other really important thing in the legislation was the mandate. What the legislation did was require physicians, or actually the way the legislation is written, just requires that pulse forms be submitted. When we went through our rules process, the rules process had language that stated that physicians or the healthcare provider have to submit or cause to be submitted the form. And the reason we put the cause to be submitted form, we didn't really want to pin the actual act of faxing to the physician or healthcare provider. If you want a good comedic value, watch me try to use a fax machine while I'm working in the emergency department. It doesn't happen well. So having an office staff or policies in place, basically, so that these are submitted would meet that requirement. What that requirement does is it satisfies the HIPAA requirement, and that was really our biggest challenge. HIPAA allows for interchange of information when it has to do with the direct treatment of a patient. The issue with this is that this was prospectively collecting data, and so it wasn't clear that you can prospectively call somebody who's not caring for a patient just because they might care for a patient someday and say, hold on to this record for them. But the way HIPAA is written is if there is a mandatory public health requirement to report something, that HIPAA does not stand in the way. So this fulfilled that requirement. And that really was, I think, the key piece of the legislation that enabled the Pulse Registry to function the way it does and function correctly. I think other things to point out also include our Pulse Registry Advisory Committee. They served as the committee that helped shepherd the rules process. We had them up and running by early October. The committee, the legislation calls for two members of the public. Dr. Goldberg felt it was very important that there be at least four members of the public. So the legislation allows him to create a larger committee, so he required us to find at least two more public members so that we felt comfortable that the message was being well vetted by public members with an interest in these issues. And I think those were sort of my main points.
Excellent.
And again, any other questions that you may have?
Well, I want to thank you very much. This is one of the, I think, extremely important pieces of House Bill 2009 from last session, and it looks like it's being implemented extremely well. So I want to thank you for all your work in getting all the pieces together so that we could actually have a product where the outcomes are really looking good.
Thank you so much, and I will extend your congratulations to Dr. Terry Schmidt, who presented with me previously and is on medical relief mission in Haiti.
All right. Thank you very much.
You.
With that, we'll close the informational hearing, and colleagues, I want to open basically a work session on Senate Bill 1029. Mr. Bacobian, you want to give us a review of what that is? We're not moving this bill, by the way, but I want to get something on the record. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we did hear this previously. It does require DC, Department of Consumer Business Services to order insurers to pay attorney fees and cost to consumer representatives that contest health insurance premium rate filing and substantially contribute to the adoption of final order. Requires DCBS Insurance Division to determine whether the premium rates are proposed by insurer for health benefits for small employers and health benefit plans satisfy criteria specified by the measure.
Okay. We had testimony from the Department of Consumer and Business on Tuesday. The Insurance Division was here, and we believe, and this is why I want to get on the record, that the division is on track to adopt rules related to rate review that are definitely consistent with the legislative intent of House Bill 2009, which changes the process for determining whether materials submitted in a rate filing should be withheld from public disclosure from an individual case-by-case determination to a determination through rulemaking that will determine which data, if any, should be withheld from disclosure. So, as far as I'm concerned, it is our understanding that the proposed rules of the division, they do not identify any material to be withheld from disclosure. And this determination in the rules is consistent with the intent of House Bill 2009. So I just wanted to get that on the record. This bill was intended to be before us in case that intent was not there, and it obviously is. So is there any comment? All right. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1029, and can I open a public hearing? Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3625.
Representative Tomei will be here in just one second.
Yeah, Representative Tomei is on her way, but it is Sheila. Let's see.
Wendy Davis.
Kathleen
Bradley.
And Kathleen Bradley first.
Is Kathleen here? Oh, well, I guess go ahead and call up folks in order.
Okay. So then if they're not here, then we have...
Wendy Davis is here.
Okay, Wendy, go ahead.
And
as soon as Representative Tomei comes, I'd like to have her. But go ahead, and if you're here to testify, be here just in case she's not coming. All right. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Wendy Davis from Portland, here to support Bill 3625 to declare May as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month. And Senator Mona Anderson and members of the Senate Health Committee, I really appreciate the time that you take to listen to our testimony. We were here last year and successfully, with your help, passed the bill that created a maternal mental health task force in the state of Oregon that Catherine Bradley will talk about when she gets here. We've had three meetings already. We're just doing really a great body of significant work that will come back to the legislature to report on gaps and services available in Portland, in Oregon, the whole state of Oregon, for pregnant and postpartum families to deal with mental health issues. And what this bill, to have this bill, to have a month every year that brings awareness to maternal mental health statewide, is such a wonderful bill to have in tandem with the task force. For myself, I'm a psychotherapist, a consultant, and a national educator specializing in maternal mental health. I've been a volunteer, an advocate, a therapist, and a survivor of postpartum depression. And I know personally and professionally how important it is to bring the topic of mental health for childbearing women and their families out of the shadows and into public conversation, that no matter how many wonderful doctors, therapists, books, medications we have to treat depression and anxiety during pregnancy and postpartum, nothing works if the family is too ashamed and too embarrassed to come out to tell us what's going on. And to have a month every year that brings awareness to this does exactly that, to let everyone know this is common. This is not something to be ashamed about, and this is something that's treatable. I put in my written testimony, I thought it would be interesting for you to hear the latest data that Oregon has in the latest study of over 1,800 new moms, found that by self-report, 20.4% said they felt depressed either during or after pregnancy. 15.8% said they'd been depressed often or always depressed during pregnancy alone. And 10.8% reported they were often or always depressed since their baby was born alone. So we're looking at rates during pregnancy, after, during postpartum, are equally high. And they're higher for single mothers. They're higher for mothers of low income status. The rate of postpartum psychosis, which is the most dangerous perinatal illness, occurs in at least 1 to 2 per thousand births, which as a illness is a pretty high rate of incidence. We know this affects the babies, this affects older children, this affects dads, this affects our workplace, this affects our culture. And we would be so happy to have a public declaration every year that says this is something we all want to work on together. It's part of, that's a common experience for many families, and we want to help families come out, tell us what's going on, and be able to reach out and get the help they need. It provides a model around the country. There are probably, in my knowledge, 6 or 7 states that are also moving towards May as Maternal Mental Health Month, and I think that this will add to a national picture and leadership. And I'm really proud of Oregon for being ahead of the curve on this. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Tomei is here, so I'd like her to come up next so she can get back to wherever she needs to go.
Right there, maybe. Stay right there. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Sorry. Oh, I assume you haven't spoken yet?
No.
Okay, good. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Southeast Portland and Milwaukee. Madam Chair, some years ago, you were co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and I've been co-chair of that alliance since you left our chamber. And this is one of the issues that came before the alliance. I have written testimony, but I'm not going to give it, and I'll give you my written testimony, because this presenter did a much more eloquent job than I could about why this is important. One in eight women, that is just an astounding figure. And once we talked about this, both in committee and in the Women's Health Wellness Alliance, women's eyes opened, and even the men's eyes and the committee opened when they realized, my gosh, my wife suffered from this when she had her child. One of the guys went home and asked his wife, did you have postpartum depression? Were you depressed after our baby was born? And she said, yeah, you didn't notice, did you? So it's an important issue. And it's an important issue in terms of not just the mothers, but it's an important issue regarding the children, because we know how brains develop in those early days, in those early weeks. And if the mother is depressed, there isn't that kind of stimulation that those children get that helps increase that stimulation from smiling and playing with the child, etc. So this is an extremely important issue, and I feel honored working with these women who have brought it to our attention and have gotten the support of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance and of these chambers. So I'll leave you my written testimony, but they speak much more eloquently than I. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Representative Tomei, for bringing this forward.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, then let's have, is it Sila? Sila? Andor and Maria
Adesi.
Adesi, okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sila Andor, and I would like to thank you for hearing us out this morning. I am from Corvallis, and I am a little nervous.
That's quite all right.
I'm a volunteer with Postpartum Support International, helping mothers and families with perinatal depression and anxiety. I have also led support groups and founded a nonprofit agency based in Corvallis and Eugene, Caldwell Mama, with the same intentions. I'm also a clinician and a survivor of perinatal depression and anxiety myself. In terms of awareness, I had a really difficult perinatal period, and part of that was that my son was on life support as a newborn for the first 3 weeks, and I have interacted at that time with over 100 medical providers at two hospitals, and nobody ever gave me a pamphlet on perinatal depression or anxiety, and nobody ever asked me the question of whether I had any of those symptoms. And by the time I developed suicidal thinking some months postpartum, I kept wondering why that was and why I had to figure this issue out online on my own. And years later, when I really got to this point of traveling up to Salem to testify now, I think it's just the third time, and I'm still very nervous, I'm realizing that this is a public health issue and this is an awareness issue, and that was the reason why none of those 100 and some providers never asked me the question. And this is the reason why I still today very often receive clients in my support groups and in my practice where they come from a doctor who told them, no, this is not postpartum. You're 3-4 months out. This has nothing to do with having a baby. Even providers, really, many of them have no idea what these illnesses are about and the fact that they are treatable. And just wanted to be here today, and thank you very much for listening to us, and I would very much want to support this bill, and I have more in my written testimony that you have a copy of. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming, and especially it means so much more to actually have personal experiences brought before the committee, so thank you very much. It takes a brave soul to do that. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Anderson and gentlemen. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Maria Desi, and I am a provider through groups hired by the Behavioral Care Network. In 2000, Behavioral Care Network manages the mental health money out of the prevention, so the need to begin to address this issue. And the program was introduced in 5 counties. Since then, I am the provider for Marion and Polk County. I run groups with another instructor assistant in English and Spanish, 4 groups in Polk and Marion and in Spanish, and 1 in English. Through the wonderful partnership with other agencies in the community, I run the English groups on Fridays out of the Salem Hospital that provides the free space. In the rest of the county, the both counties through other agencies like churches and other providers who want to donate the time. Since then, my experience not only as a provider, as a qualified mental health associate, is being of a wonderment because the women who I have the privilege to touch their lives through my service have been so grateful. And like already been has been mentioned, there's such a shame and such a fear. Many women, they said, I didn't say this because I was so afraid that my children be taken away, even through pregnancy. We were very fortunate the Behavioral Care Network hired a team from OHSU to come and train medical providers who wanted to participate and had to diagnose postpartum depression early on during their visits with their providers. It was wonderful to see the medical profession engage, and they are the main providers of referrals. Even though they are engaged referring these women to our programs, the women, because of the shame, because of the fears and concerns they have, and just because of depression, they hesitate engaging and responding. And I would like just to say something, that it is easy to raise a boy to be a good man than to fix many men and women out there in the world. And just thinking that these little children are going to grow up to probably change our diapers, hopefully not, but we want them to be good citizens that will contribute to this wonderful state of Oregon, this wonderful country. As you can hear my accent, since 1971 that I came on a vacation to the United States, it has not ended. Since then, I raised three beautiful daughters, but with the same story of many women, not untouched by postpartum depression. When I had my second child, the same day that she was born, my father died, and there was nothing addressed. Just, you have to stay in the hospital longer with another baby in another emergency room at a naval hospital. Just lost the numbness through my body. It took years to be taken care of because there was nothing addressing. The wonderful thing that I had was beautiful women that embraced me in my community. But without them, I would have been lost. My children would have been lost. Since then, through all these wonderful support that these women do not have, because they're isolated, because they're single mothers, because their partners have moved on, they really don't have a chance. The worst and saddest thing, because we are human beings here to be in relationships, the most unfortunate thing in their lives that I see is that they continue selecting partners that cannot be there for them. Not only to share the joy of bringing this child into the world, but to share the responsibility. It breaks my heart, and I hope, and I really dream on this day that we can continue normalizing the life of these women, letting them know that it's not their fault. They are not alone, that we support them, and that they will be given a chance to raise, again, wonderful children. My oldest daughter, right out of high school, went into the Naval Academy, has been an officer for 9 years, and now she has a baby. She went to Iraq, came back, and she's going to be a mother. I'm going to be there for her because I know that what life has brought into her life most likely will put her at risk. Because it runs in families. If I had it, she probably will have it too. I know my other two daughters also suffer from depression, but being there for them made a difference.
Thank you.
So thank you all.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much. Is there any questions for the panel? Thank you very much for coming and sharing your stories. We so appreciate it. And with that, I'd like to call Kathleen Bradley and Brian Bollinger.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Morris Anderson and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. We're here today to speak in support of House Bill 3625. This resolution dovetails nicely with the national designation of May as Mental Health Awareness Month, and May 7th is National Children's Mental Health Awareness Day, so it lets us sort of cluster several different activities around that time, which we think is very important. We do want to draw your attention, and I handed out as well a copy of Maternal Depression in Oregon, which is our PRAMS, our Oregon Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System. This kind of gives you more direct information about the impact of maternal depression on Oregon. About 23% of our new mothers report that they're depressed during or after a pregnancy. And as you will be able to see on the back of it, it is disproportionately represented in some of our minority populations. We have been very appreciative of the support of the legislature in terms of looking at issues around maternal depression. The passage last year of House Joint Resolution 15, which recognized last March as Maternal Mental Health Month, and then also House Bill 2666, which was the formation of the Maternal Mental Health Work Group. That work group has started. The work is ongoing, and a report will be coming back to this body in September. We have a very very impressive group of providers and citizens from across Oregon that are working with us in shaping that. And finally, I also just want to thank that I appreciate having this work linked to the Early Childhood Council, because we really are trying to do a better job in Oregon in linking our early childhood initiatives, leveraging them, aligning them across different agencies and provider groups. So although it seems like a small piece, it's actually important in terms of supporting our integration of work. We are here from the Office of Family Health to answer any questions you might have, and just very supportive of our community partners. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This sounds like a combination of genetics and societal pressures. It sounds like genetics, but if it's passed on from generation to generation, as one individual mentioned.
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Morissette, the issue of depression does have a mix of both biological and genetic issues. What we're mostly trying to address within the work of the task force and the importance of this is doing a lot of education, because it's poorly understood in the community. Yeah. As I think the earlier speaker spoke to, you know, women in particular feel that it's not appropriate for them not to feel excited and happy, and are they being a bad mother? So there are a lot of messages and a lot of confusion. So we're really trying to focus on issues of education, yeah, understanding, and then doing a better job of linking community resources.
Yeah, I'm a little confused here. Clearly, I don't remember all of the things we passed last session. But correct in hearing you say that we did a resolution that made March Maternal Mental Health Month. Is that true?
Chair Mo Sanderson and Senator Cruz, it was just for that one time.
Just one time thing. Okay. I would hate to think we were doing two different months.
No. Okay. And thank you for that
clarification. Well, I mean, you know, if we'd done that and then we're making... okay.
And we're actually very pleased with May, because it does some of the other mental health work.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that we were doing
We need
months.
To move on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. You have our written comments. I'm Brian Barringer with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm one of the two men on the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and as the father of two daughters, see this as well. And this is a very important issue for the Oregon Medical Association, and what this bill does is helps with public and provider awareness, and we think that's very important, so we support the bill as well.
Excellent. Any other questions? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3625 and open a work session on House Bill 3625.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. Is there someone that would like to carry the bill?
You would.
All right, I'll carry the bill.
I don't see anybody else qualified.
With that, I'll close the work session.
You're the most qualified member of the committee.
All right, thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 3625 and open a work session on House Bill 1046.
Senate Bill
1046. One of the first things that I want to do, colleagues, is we received a letter from Representative Kenemer, and I need to put that on the record. He said, "Dear Senator Mona Sanderson, it was with great concern that I learned during your hearing today, which was February 9th, that a senator impugned my integrity and suggested that I had misinformed and been coercive toward the interim work group and the process when I was quoted as saying, 'This is the way it has to happen.' I believe that this statement is a troubling misrepresentation of both my intent and my words. I ask that the chair request the work group minutes and correct the public record. I have not reviewed the work group records, but I'm confident the record will sustain my view." So what I did is I, because the work group records were supposed to be confidential, and the work group members said that that which was said during the work group would be confidential, I just asked one of the members of the committee to give me the piece on what Representative Kenemer did say. In fact, I looked at what I had said too, and basically what he did is he gave a brief history and overview of the bill. He explained to the group how House Bill 2702 came to be, describing the controversy that got started, which led to the creation of the work group as a means of resolving that controversy. And he noted his belief that the legislature will be ready to move on the next steps of this process come the special session in February. And to that end, he asked that the group put together a quality product bill that can be brought to the February 2010 legislative session. And he stressed that if this group can develop a bill, it will serve as the center of any legislative discussions. If the bill comes forward with a strong recommendation from the group, it likely will move forward as written. And if it were to come forward with a wavering of the group, he felt it was likely to move forward in favor of providing prescriptive authority to psychologists. In response to a question from a work group member, Representative Kenemer said the bill was a nonpartisan effort of the legislature. I basically, on the next meeting, basically said the same thing. And then I do want to bring forward the testimony that was made in May 29th, and I want to get that information out before you. Do you have that? And that, okay, I need a copy.
Okay.
I have it. Okay, here it is. Basically, this was our May 28, 2009 testimony from the Senate Committee on Healthcare Veterans Affairs. And basically, what Senator Bates had said that he said, "The psychiatrists, I hope, understand that we need a clear pathway for psychologists to start prescribing medications. This is not a delaying tactic to form this work group. We have to come back in January with the plan. There has to be consensus, and it can't be seen just as another delay, another turf battle." And this goes beyond that now, and just, I want this on the record very clearly, in 5-6 months from now, or whenever we're back in here, which I expect will be February, that we're ready to roll with something that everyone's agreed to, that protects the public but opens up opportunities for the public at the same time. So I brought this forward just to give you what was on the public record in the testimony from the Senate Committee on Healthcare on May 25th, and also from the work group of what Kenemer and I said. So I think that clarifies the record.
Madam Chair, may
yes.
I speak?
Yes.
I do not want to get into a he said, she said type of argument here. I want to start by saying if Representative Kenemer feels I impugned him, I apologize for that. I reported what members of the work group had told me, that what their perception of what he said to them was. And that perception was that if they didn't come up with a work product, that the previous bill was going to be passed through from the House to the Senate or Senate to the House. That was report from what they told me. I was not there for those meetings. We have no records of those meetings. We have no actual written testimony from those meetings. So I think it's impossible for us to know who said what to who during that time. And I reported what was the perception that was given to those people as they reported to me, and I will stay by that. It was only a perception. I was not there. I haven't got a recording of those, of what was actually said or not said. but I do not want to get into an argument today of who said what at which particular time. I've made my statements on it before, and I must state what I've previously stated, but I will make a moment here to apologize to Representative Kenmer if he felt he was impugned. I was not trying to impugn him. I was trying to express to the committee the perception that I was given by certain members of that work group. Thank you.
All right. With that, I'd like to move on, and we have some amendments. We've already adopted the dash fives. Have we discussed? We haven't really discussed the dash sixes. Is that correct?
Let me kind of recap them.
And the dash sevens. So I would like Senator Bates. He brought forward the dash sevens, which is based on a PA model, and he wanted to put that forward. And I do want to make sure that that the committee realizes that this committee, this Committee on Psychology, under the Oregon Medical Board, can only make recommendations. It is the medical board that is going to actually adopt whatever comes out of the subcommittee of the medical board. So I know that Senator Morris had an idea that he felt would also how we could allow psychologists to prescribe, and I said it was too late for another bill because the bill has to pass out of committee today in whatever form we decide. But do you want to just state first what your idea was, Senator Morris, so we can get it on the record, so at least the medical board, because whichever bill will pass, it's going to be under the medical board.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for that opportunity. As a layperson, this has been almost an impossible task to weigh conflicting viewpoints within two very respected professions. Very, very respected professions. And it seems to me that it's in the best interest of the state of Oregon that we have prescriptive authority for clinical doctoral psychologists. And so I drafted just a conceptual amendment that would keep this process going, but going in the direction we want it to go. And if I may, Madam Chair, just read briefly what I believe would be the essence of keeping this process moving. Whereas the Legislative Assembly finds that it is in the public's best interest to provide greater access to the full range of mental health treatments, and whereas doctoral clinical psychologists desire to expand their scope of practice to provide a greater range of mental health treatment options, the Legislative Assembly hereby directs the Oregon Medical Board, the Board of Clinical Psychological Examiners, and the Oregon Health and Science University to collaboratively present to the 2011 Legislative Assembly the appropriate curriculum, training, and certification to allow doctoral clinical psychologists the authority to prescribe psychotropic drugs within the scope of their clinical psychology practice. And I think it's important to keep this discussion going. I hate to see it die.
I don't think it will die because it is going to be under, whatever we pass out, it's going to be under the medical board. And if there are problems, it's I think, very difficult to get two professions that have worked very independently and both are very passionate about their own independent practice to get together. And we're sort of forcing the issue. We're forcing the issue because we're not meeting the needs of our mental health in this state, and hopefully this is going to resolve that. But with that, we only have 45 minutes left, and we do need to pass something out today. So I'll start with Senator Bates in the dash 7 amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and make as brief as I can for you. First off, I will tell you I would support the statements just made by Senator Frank Morris. We're trying to do something that is very difficult in a 30-day session. The amount of controversy in this bill already registered in the last week, I think, leads me to believe we shouldn't be doing it now at all. I don't believe we have to pass anything out at this time. I think it's a mistake to do so. I have 30 years of experience dealing with and collaborating with psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, taking care of thousands of patients and the interaction amongst them. And I firmly believe that it's going to be in the best interest of the people of the state of Oregon that we do have ability to have psychologists write prescriptions. I'm not opposed to that, and I've made that very clear all along. I also believe that the way we're looking at this at the present time is not appropriate. It's not something we should be doing as a lay board sitting here today. Now, this is really a question of, in my mind, training and oversight. We don't tell medical schools what their curriculum is going to be or how many hours they should have to do something. We don't tell any other accredited program in healthcare what that should be. We leave it up to accredited institutions to do that. We have a tried and true 20-plus year experience with a program that I believe answers all the questions that have been raised in this committee on how to go about resolving this issue. The physician assistance program has many allied healthcare professionals entered into it, some of them with PhDs, some without, some of them come out of core groups in the service, and it sets up a system that resolves issues, and it's been tried and proven to do so. First, it is automatically sets up a system that deals with the issue of collaboration, what that collaboration really means as far as oversight is concerned. Physician assistants have a very wide-based practice. They are very independent in their practice. Their supervising or collaborating physician does not have to be on site with them. Many of them are in rural areas where there's a great need for them. Because of that, they have an independent practice model that works well, has been proven to work well. There's issues here about insurance paying for things. Physician assistants get paid for what they do, and the insurance companies are accepting that. The bills before us have no discussion of that. Is Regents Blue Cross going to start paying a psychologist for the work they do and prescribing? We don't know. And it doesn't speak to it. It would have to be resolved later. The liability issue is also resolved with this. There's liability in taking on a new scope of practice. When you do it through the PA program, that liability has already been proven and taken care of through the collaborating physician and the oversight from that physician. Some people ask, why do you want me to do this to the nurse practitioner program? Well, the reason we don't do that is because you have to have an RN degree first. It's a very specific program, and asking a psychologist to go back to school and become an RN, I think, is inappropriate and a barrier to what we want to get done. The bill you'll see before you in the Dash 7 amendments is essentially a parallel to the PA practice as well. But there is some things that are significantly different in it. If a psychologist has already completed a program through DOD or any other accredited program, they can ask the board, the medical board, to have a direct entry into the program. They do not have to go through another program. So, as an example, a psychologist such as Dr. Sammons could come to this state, become licensed as he has, and directly go to the board and say, I want to start writing prescriptions, and with the board's approval could do so under the PA Act. It also asks, it demands that the PA programs develop specific programs for psychologists just to write prescriptions. They do not have to go through the routine program. It's broader and unnecessary for them. And they'd have to develop specific slots just for that.
Now, can I ask a question here?
Yes.
The background, for instance, you mentioned the nurses' training in biology and sciences and so on and so forth. The PAs have the same background, basically, don't they?
They're very broad. Okay. Some of them are former corpsmen. Some of them have allied health degrees. Some have completed a four-year program and have a Bachelor of Science in Allied Health. It's a very broad group.
So that's different. Well, okay, it's a different background than the nurses have, but it would be if they went through the PA program, modified PA program, or the PA program as it's.
This is not. This sets up a parallel program to the PA program that's for psychologists only.
Okay.
And to qualify the program, it does two things. One, it sets up a program that for direct entry into becoming a prescribing psychologist, and it also sets up a program for training at accredited schools. In the state of Oregon, we have two, one at Pacific and one at OHSU. It is separate and distinct from the programs there, but follows the same laws.
Does that program exist now? Or
it would have to be developed.
It would have to be developed.
So. And frankly, I think the question of training should not be discussed in this committee. It should be done by accredited schools. And we don't tell a medical school, as I said earlier, what to teach, what that curriculum should be, what's the quality of that curriculum, what's the breadth of that curriculum. It's something that should be done in an accredited school. I don't believe we are qualified to do that here. So, Madam Chair, this -7 amendment allows direct entry from outside the state or from someone within the state who has already gone through an accredited program, and it sets up a program under the statutes of the physician assistance program to do so. There are people in physician assistance programs who are holding PhDs or master's degrees or bachelor's degrees already from different allied fields. And a psychologist writing these prescriptions would be able to say, Dr. James Smith, PA, and go forward, and would have a close collaboration with another physician. It is a program that's worked well for the state over the last 20 years. These people can practice anywhere in the state, including areas of great need, which probably exist throughout the state, but especially in rural areas. And their practice and their license would be limited under the medical board, as it properly should be.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Could you expand on the state of Alaska just a bit? The program, a program similar to what you're describing, has worked well in the state of Alaska. Is that what you said?
I am not aware of what the state of Alaska is doing. I'm sorry.
No.
There's a program. The other two programs are in Louisiana.
Did you mention the state of
Mexico? I didn't just now, I hope.
The only states that have prescribing psychologists is New Mexico and Louisiana at this point.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, in summation, I think this is the best process we could go through to set this up and make it happen fairly quickly. Some would come in directly, immediately. There's others who would go through a training program, one that is accredited and understood by all, and not one set up by a committee of essentially lay people, myself included, who I don't think have the expertise to decide what kind of training people in healthcare should have, especially one where you're talking about prescriptions are going to be written for individuals affecting the most complex organ in our body, the human brain. So I would end there and ask for a consideration of the -7 amendments.
I appreciate your passion and your expertise on, and you do. You have a strong passion of how you feel things should go. I also have a strong passion of how things go, and that's why we referred this to a work group in which we had three psychiatrists, three psychologists, and one psychopharmacist. It's a pharmacist who's in psychopharmacology. A pharmacist with an emphasis on psychopharmacology. Three of them were from OHSU, a very well-respected institution that does education in this state. I would now like to... we don't have a fiscal on the -7s. We would have to send it to rules if we wanted to keep this alive. We do have the -6s, and I think, are there questions about the -6s? I just want to reiterate that this is solely under the medical board, and that the committee
on prescribing psychologists under the medical board can only make recommendations to the medical board. The medical board can accept or reject what this committee is, which will be made up of, and I was in error last time, and I want to put the record straight. It's 4 psychologists and 3 physicians. And I do remember in one of the committees that one of the psychiatrists says he doesn't care if there were 7 psychologists on this subcommittee as long as the Oregon Medical Board could say A or nay on whatever comes out of that committee. So there's a handout I think that you have. I think we need to give equal time to the dash sixes. You have this handout regarding Senate Bill 1046, and it actually describes what a PhD or a psychologist who has his doctorate in psychology and clinical psychology, and it gives a definition that they diagnose and treat mental disorders. They conduct psychological testing. They complete psychological evaluations and provide psychotherapy. They are licensed in Oregon as independent practitioners to treat patients, and their training can take from 4 to 7 years longer than the average medical student. Physician assistants, on the other hand, practice medicine under the supervision of a medical doctor. They are trained to provide diagnostic, therapeutic, and preventative health care services as delegated by a physician. Typically, they take health care histories, examine patients, and interpret x-rays. They treat minor injuries, prescribe medications, and carry out managerial duties such as ordering supplies. If you go to the next page...
Can I make a statement there? That is not what PAs do as a general rule. They do much more than that. Much more than that. I supervise one. I have, and if you go to the Zoom clinics in Portland, you will find they do more than that. That is, I find that demeaning to PAs.
Oh, I don't mean to say that. I was trying to just give an idea of what PAs do. This is just not a total scope. I just was trying to set a difference between what a clinical psychologist is compared to a physician assistant. And then if you go to the next page to look at the formal education, we have to realize there's a difference with someone who has a degree in clinical psychology. In order to be a prescribing psychologist, you have to get your PhD degree in clinical psychology. And then you take a national exam, and then you go through a clinical psychology residency, then a postdoctoral master's in psychopharmacology, then an 18-month clinical training, and then you'll have to pass a national exam. And if you put the two together side by side with a physician assistant prescribing a psychologist, I just wanted to let you see the difference between training. And then if you go to the third page, it actually describes the courses that a postdoctoral master's in psychopharmacology has to take versus a physician assistant in a master's degree. And I know there's been concern that the psychologist, clinical psychopharmacologist, doesn't have science. But when you take a look at the courses in clinical biochemistry, in neuroscience and neuroanatomy, in clinical medicine, in clinical pharmacology, in psychopharmacology, in special population psychopharmacology, and in physical assessment, chemical dependency, and pharmacotherapeutics. And I have it side by side on the physician's assistant. They're very different. What the psychologist and clinical psychologist is focusing on is psychology, behavior, and mental health. And physician assistant is definitely a generalist. I'm just citing the differences. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I am just saying that there is a difference in what a clinical psychologist is and what a physician assistant is.
Madam Chair, may
yes.
I comment? I understand your position and your reasoning here. I'm going to go back to my original statement. I don't find this data, for me at least, to be pertinent. We're talking about a entirely different program. You're comparing this program to the present PA program. We're not talking about the present program. We're talking about a program designed and built by accredited institutions strictly for psychologists and pertinent to them. And I go back again to saying I don't think we have the expertise in this panel to decide what that should be. I would rather give that to an accredited institution to make that decision. And comparing the present training for a PA going into general medicine is not the same as what we're talking about in the Dash 7s. I just want to make that clear. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Won't the Board of Medical Examiners make the final decision?
Yes, they will.
I mean, so they could... Yeah, okay. They could do... Okay.
I wanted to point out that the work group did look at the curricula of related training and education programs, and they looked at the PA model curriculum. They looked at the OHSU psychiatry residency curriculum. They looked at the psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner curriculum. They looked at the Master of Clinical Health Services degree curriculum. I'm not sure what the APA model is curriculum, but they looked at that one. They looked at the Alliant International's curriculum, which is and the Oregon Council on Naturopathic Physicians Formulary and the U.S. Armed Services Psychopharmacology curriculum. So they did look at those in the work group, and we have to, again, I will repeat, this work group was not charged with deciding whether psychologists should prescribe or not, but to come up with a consensus of a program in which they had to meet three criteria. What is the education, what is the training, and what is the oversight? And there was give and take on both sides with this. So, with that, any other further comments from the committee?
Are we discussing the Dash 6 amendments right now? Hold on, to be sure.
Mm-hmm. The Dash 6s basically clarify, at the very beginning, the psychiatrists and the physicians came forward with a Dash 1 amendment. But then they decided, and they said that they thought that they would go forward and accept the bill if we would do the Dash 1 amendments. But then, after our first meeting, they withdrew the Dash amendments. So what I did is I took as much as I felt was appropriate from the Dash 1 amendments and put them in the Dash 6 amendments. And so the Dash 6s, if I can find them here, well, I want to find my cheat sheet.
Okay.
Just a minute here. This file is extremely big. If I can just find the Dash ones, that's all I need. Okay, there was a concern that regarding the rulemaking, there was concern that the formulary, the prescribing psychologist formulary, was not truly under the jurisdiction of the medical board. And so that was clarified in the dash sixes, that the Oregon Medical Board, with concurrence with the Oregon Board of Pharmacology Examiners, would be coming out in the final rulemaking there. So that was one piece that was put in the dash sixes. The other is on page 2 of the bill, line 18, wanted to make sure that we want to make recommendations to the Oregon Medical Board for the prescribing psychologist formulary. So we wanted to make sure that it is the medical board that is going to establish the psychologist formula. What the committee will do is make recommendations to the Oregon Medical Board. So that is in it. They had asked in the dash ones that the committee be 8 members instead of 7 members. I did not accept that because I felt that there needs to be a check and balances, and it's really fair to have a majority. It's not fair, I feel, to have a majority of psychiatrists. It is known, like in Louisiana, that they couldn't get anywhere with the psychologists and the psychiatrists when they became at odds. So they put everything under the medical board, but we have set it up so that the recommendations would come from a committee that has a majority of psychologists, but it's the medical board that will make the final decision on what should be implemented. In section 3 of the bill, they wanted to make sure that persons under the age of 18, that psychologists could not prescribe to them. And so what we did is that we actually added that besides the primary care physician, a prescribing psychologist has to be working with a primary care physician, making sure that there are medical histories taken, that's for any patient. But what we added to those under the age of 18, that they have to also consult with a child psychiatrist. So that was what was added also in the dash sixes. And there has been concern, well, there aren't that many child psychiatrists. Well, I think this put barriers up. So, yes, a prescribing psychologist could not prescribe. If there's a problem, the Oregon Medical Board can change that. The next change that was in the dash ones, they wanted to make sure that at least one-third of the training program is completed in person and not via telephone, and there's no program in existence that does that, so I left that out. In section 4, in section 4, they wanted to make sure that the clinical training was full-time. Again, I didn't feel that was appropriate because there are some people who are working and have a job. I felt that would really be putting barriers up, so that's why I didn't make that change. And then it said the dash one amendments had is supervised by at least 3 medical doctors, and it would be very difficult to find 3 medical doctors. Again, they wanted changes in on page 3, section 4, subset 2, and we clarified this, that this group, this prescribing group, this psychology committee, prescribing psychologist committee, it's only recommendations that come out of that group, and the board of medical examiners or the medical board would say A or nay to that. And that is again clarified, another recommendation. Only recommendations come from this group, and rulemaking is actually established by the medical board. And I think those were all the main changes in 6. Let's see. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we adopted the 5s, I remember the the discussion about whether this was liability protection. And in reading the sixes, where I mean, because what we're requiring of a psychologist for old people, those over 18, is a collaboration, and I think there may be some protection there. I guess one of the concerns I have is because when we're dealing with kids, whether you can find a child psychiatrist or not, is this is. Not a collaboration, it's a consultation, which is a tighter relationship. So I'm not sure that I think liability attaches with that term.
The intent is actually to have a consult working with the primary care physician. That was made very, very clear in the work group, that there needed to be a working relationship with the prescribing psychologist and the primary care physician, and that it had to be documented in the medical record of what was transpired between the primary care physician. That's the intent.
Okay, Madam Chair, I understand that my point here is the liability point, because I think what we're attempting to do with primary care physicians was have a relationship that where liability didn't necessarily attach for independent action. I think
Yes. When
we're dealing with the kids, just by the different terminology, because as a consultation, I think that's a tighter relationship, and I'm not sure it unattaches at that point. And it may be a concern, because if we're assuming we still want the same sort of independence on the back end of that, I don't mm-hmm. think we're achieving it. And it's a legal question, and I don't know the answer, but it's kind of a red flag.
Senator Morissette, and then Senator Bates.
There will be rules made by the Board of Medical Examiners, and the collaboration for geriatrics will be spelled out and so on, right?
Yes, that is supposed to happen. I think that your point, Senator Bates, and then we'll...
Okay.
Because I want to...
Madam Chair, the very complexity of the conversation we're having right now about this bill leads me to believe this is not the time and place to deal with this. This is a short session. We're rushing a bill out today because it's our last day. We have to put bills out, or we lose these bills, or send them to rules or ways and means. This is a very complex issue, and all the things we just started talking about are very real issues. There's more behind those. I don't know if the medical board has the capacity or ability to do the things we're asking to do. I've not talked to them. They might not. I don't know how they're going to concur or not concur with the State Board of Psychological Examiners. We're now talking about an online program, essentially, with no face-to-face real clinical experience. There's liability issues. And it just seems like it's a hodgepodge now of putting pieces together here, there, and everywhere, trying to get something out that is a very important issue and needs to be done very carefully. I just don't feel we're there yet. I know of no major medical group that supports the Dash Sixes. I believe that psychologists support this. At least half of them do. And the fact that these groups no longer support, and in fact, oppose these issues, it gives me real pause about what we're doing here today. So I'd ask the committee to think carefully about this. I would prefer that we defer this to, as a minimum, to the January session, when we have a real long and a significant length of time to look at these issues more carefully. I really would support Senator Morris's proposal as the best one, frankly. I personally think, from my experience, that if parties came together and thought about this long enough, a PA-like program is what's necessary. But that is very much my opinion. So, Madam Chair, I'm very concerned about the conversation here today. I'm very concerned about complexities in this that have not been answered, and that we're rushing something through in the face of time constraints that are not appropriate for a legislation of this significance.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I'm also, because you said the board can do a lot of things by rule, but I'm looking, I mean, it says, the language in here says that requiring an ongoing collaborative relationship with a healthcare professional, and which is somewhat undefined. You know, I guess one of my concerns on this is that a lot of the folks that are probably needing this sort of additional enhanced ability of a psychologist isn't necessarily going to have a primary care physician, and I'm not sure how the board can deal with that in rule when it says that that's what it has to be.
Senator Morissette.
I'm supporting the DASIC, and I will support passing the bill out because I believe that there will be oversight. You will have hearings. You will have updates. You will have people coming to your to our committee discussing this. Rulemaking, I think, is a part of this. I think that there's that the Board of Medical Examiners will make the final decision, no matter how many psychologists are on the board. That was a quote from someone. And I'm comfortable with this. I think that I hate it for us to start over again. I think we've come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are built-in safeguards, and there is oversight, and things can be changed legislatively if we have to. But I just think we're on the right track.
Madam Chair, if I could, I appreciate your attempt to deal with to separate out kids in the sixes. I'd almost prefer passing the bill without the sixes because I do think it creates a liability nexus that isn't in the original bill. And I may be wrong. I'm just looking at the verbiage here, and I think we're creating for those psychologists who want to work with kids their ability to find a psychiatrist who is willing to take on the liability might not exist.
I feel that there's concern regarding anybody prescribing to children.
Oh, absolutely.
And so this is a safeguard that I feel is all right. I do want you to know we do not have a fiscal on the dash sevens. We do have a fiscal on the dash sixes. And so the medical board has already looked at this and is aware of what is coming down the pike if we so choose to pass this out. So I would like to entertain a motion on the dash sixes.
Madam Chair, as I've told you before, that I would help you move this to Ways and Means if you fix the kids issue. This is your best attempt. I'm going to honor my commitment to you. I'll move the Dash 6 amendment to 1046.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 1046. Is there any discussion?
I think I made my position very clear on this. I think this is a significant change in how we practice medicine in the state of Oregon. I think it's being done in haste. I think it's being done under the pressure brought on by various groups. And I think we have to tread this very lightly, and I think it's a mistake. And I base that on not only my own personal experience of 30 years in practice in dealing with these issues, but also in the fact that as far as I know at this point, there is no major medical group in this state that supports this bill, other than practicing psychologists who have obviously a vested interest in this. I think this is something we have to think very carefully about. I urge my fellow committee members not to act in haste. Gather more information. Think this through. This is not something that has to happen now. Two states have done this. Hundreds of times this has come up in other states and voted. Hundreds of times. And now we're going to do this in a four-week session, which we have about a week and a half to look at issues like this. Despite all the work that was done ahead of time, I don't believe we're there. I think this is a terrible mistake. I'm going to vote no, strongly no.
And I do think that Oregon has always been on the cutting edge in access, and in I look at what we did with nurse practitioners. We are the cutting edge on allowing nurses to prescribe, cutting edge on naturopathic physicians. We are. This is very different. And we had no medical group supporting those efforts when we passed them through this body. Any other comments? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
No.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Miles Anderson?
Aye. Amendment adopted. Do I have a motion?
Sir?
Yeah.
This is a tough position. Okay. The bill as it now stands will allow prescriptive authority based on a master's degree in clinical psychopharmacology.
A PhD.
A PhD, but a master's in clinical psychopharmacology. So we're talking about the qualifications, the training and the qualifications, the curriculum and all of those things. I'm not prepared to support this bill based on that training. And the reason why is because there's not enough consensus to do that. As I've stated very clearly, I want this to move forward because I think it's in the best interest of the population and the public of Oregon to have an expanded mental health treatment option. I think that truly is the case. We're underserved in so many areas. The question, and I've made phone calls to physicians, and I've listened to the issues, and the issue is not whether you grant. Now, but I find it also interesting within the clinical psychologists. There's not unanimity, by the way, in that side of the ledger. But notwithstanding that issue, I'm still prepared to advance this. But I'm not prepared to adopt this bill. But if here's a solution for your consideration. If we move this bill to rules with a recommendation that we adopt, that they adopt an amendment similar to what I had proposed, so that you keep this moving and you actually have a finished product that comes back from these respective two boards and highly respected institution that has that qualification identified and drive it from that perspective, then I think we have something that we can approve. But professionally, I'm at a loss when it comes to making determinations about whether a master's degree in psychopharmacology, as determined by the materials that we have been presented, I can't make that judgment. I rely on the professionals to do it, and we have a divided house.
And I respect that. So scope of practice always has a divided house, and I personally feel very comfortable in having this under the medical board. Any recommendations that come out of this prescribing committee is going to go to the medical board, and they are the only ones that can deny or provide a license to prescribe. Regarding process on sending to rules, I would have to get the president's permission to do that. I've asked for another bill to be sent, and they do not want bills. And I'm almost 99% sure that leadership would not allow this bill to go to rules. If we wanted to make a phone call to the president's office, we certainly could, but it's my prerogative that I think we should just move this to Ways and Means, and then if the president of if Ways and Means wants to move it to rules, they could do that from rules. You know?
I don't know.
Do you know?
No, I don't know.
It won't come back. They would send it back to this committee, and then we could move it.
And I want to make it crystal clear. This is not a scope of practice question anymore. We all agree this happened. It's training and oversight.
And
the bill just passed is not adequate training. It's not adequate oversight, any way you cut it. And the medical board may or may not be able to fix that for us.
And I vehemently disagree with you on that one. So with that, I would like to entertain a motion for the bill.
Could you have the committee stand at ease for a moment?
Yes, we will be in recess.
right, let's reconvene the Health Policy Committee, Senate Health Policy Committee. We're still in negotiation. As you know, we only could meet in groups of two because we cannot meet in groups of three because that is a quorum. We are still talking now with the psychologists. There are phone calls being made. So what we're going to do is we're going to recess until 3 o'clock. And just to get information, more information from the stakeholders. And so So we are going to recess until 3, until we have more information. Yes, Rick.
Something. And we'll probably have to meet in a different room since someone's already scheduled for that. Probably at that time.
Yeah. So we're going to meet in a secret room and not tell anybody where it is.
I will contact
have a work group.
I'll contact each member and put out a note on our government delivery system where the meeting room will be. Maybe it'll be back here.
And just to let you know, what we think is on the table is either a concept that Senator Morse put forward, or the Dash Sixes. Those are the only two options that we are considering at this point in time, just to make it perfectly clear.
Not an either or, it could be both. So.
And it could be both. I don't know.
I don't know.
So, with that, I am going to adjourn until...
Recess.
I mean, yes, I'm going to recess until 3 this afternoon, and the committee administrator will let us know where.
Yeah.